Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Fashion designer Rick Owen says his unusual furniture, now on show in West Hollywood, owes a debt to an unlikely source.
There's this movie that's out called Troublemakers, and it's all about the land artists of the 70s. And that moment of breaking out of the gallery space and going into the middle of the desert and making these huge earthworks, that's just thrilling to me. You know, I have that movie on every morning while I'm showering with the sound off, just to have those visuals.
Hear from Rick Owens coming up. Let's turn first, though, to President Trump's plans to roll back CAFE standards. Those are the gas mileage levels set for cars and light trucks in the US. Might this policy change affect California in ways that go beyond Tesla's bottom line? First, a backgrounder on Trump's proposal, which was announced last week. Tony Barboza covers air quality and the environment at the Los Angeles Times.
Right. What happened is an announcement that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will be reevaluating or shelving Obama administration era standards on fuel economy that affect cars and trucks.
Also known as CAFE standards, is that right?
Right. These are standards that go through about 2025 and would require pretty big changes, increases in fuel economy up to about 54 miles per gallon by that year. And this came at the request of the automakers. So this is actually moving forward. Now, the EPA has cited, you know, the new administrator, Scott Pruitt, cited cost in part of the decision. He said that these standards are costly for automakers and the American people. And he says they're going to take another look at them. A big impetus behind this particular rule was to push the industry toward electrification. So there's a sense that retreating on these rules would kind of give a disincentive to that trend, which is, of course, very important here in California, where you've had a state government that has really pushed for greater electrification of vehicles.
What are the powers of the state to push back against these federal mandates?
Well, these rules were the product of a compromise between automakers and the Obama administration several years ago and California, where they all kind of agreed on to take the same tact. Now, California has sort of a special, unique authority under the Clean Air Act, where our state is actually allowed to enact or adopt stricter air pollution standards. And this goes back to the fact that California was fighting air pollution before the Clean Air Act was even passed. So it's kind of grandfathered in this power to go beyond, you know, above and beyond the federal government. So what air quality officials in California say they're going to do is that they're just going to forge ahead with these greenhouse gas standards with the EPA or not, and they're going to be using this authority. It kind of sets up a fight between California and the federal government over whether the federal government's going to allow that to continue.
That's Tony Barboza. He's environment reporter at the Los Angeles Times. As you heard, he mentioned California's leading role in cleaning air.
Los Angeles suffers the worst blanket of smog in its history. The giant California city is shrouded by the ugly mist, dangerous to health and traffic.
That's a clip from a 1943 newsreel. And back then, air pollution was plaguing the paradise of Southern California. Not long after that report, the state legislature kicked off what would become decades of regulations, and California became a global leader in the fight for cleaner air. Now, along the way, there were some fairly kooky ideas for getting rid of smog.
Los Angeles smog has always intrigued the amateur inventor. One of the first suggestions, and it is constantly being repeated, is that giant fans be mounted on the rim of the basin, fans that would blow the pollution away. Unfortunately, there isn't enough electrical energy in the world to propel those fans, and if there were, the concentrated smog that they would push out would kill every living thing in its path.
That's a plan from the 1950s. Now planners and elected officials are confident enough in improvements to air quality that they are allowing a surge of construction of homes close to freeways. Tony Barboza, an LA Times co-author, reported on the trend, writing that, quote, California air regulators say air quality along freeways will continue to improve as the state transitions to cleaner vehicles and fuels. They also cited Mayor Eric Garcetti, stating that he does not want to limit this construction and that, quote, improving air filtration, building design and tailpipe emissions are a better way to reduce risks to residents. But what happens to this vision if CAFE standards are rolled back? First to Professor Yifang Zhu. She is at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, and she's an expert in ultra-fine particle emissions. She studied the impact of air pollution on communities from Boyle Heights to Beijing, and she's opposed to putting homes near freeways even now, saying tailpipes emit a toxic stew.
They produce both greenhouse gases and air pollutants that cause adverse health effects. So you lot more carbon dioxide be emitted into the atmosphere. Along with those carbon monoxide, there's also particulate matters, volatile organic compounds, nitrogen oxides, all kinds of air pollutants will go with carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And those contribute to air pollution and contribute to adverse health effects. Air pollution has been documented worldwide that contribute to premature death. And those the efforts that California have put in into the so many years to clean up the air, if a setback on the rollback of the CAFE standards could set us on a very wrong trajectory.
Back to the LA Times, Tony Barboza.
Now, the issue as far as home building near freeways that we found was that while you may have declining tailpipe emissions, you have an increase in the population living around high traffic areas. So what we found is that the city is building an increasing amount of housing. They built in the city of Los Angeles alone, you had over 4,000 homes built in 2015 close to freeways and another 3,000 last year. And the idea for concern here is that you've got an increased population in a known polluted zone, and the tailpipe emissions are not declining fast enough. So to the extent that the progress in moving the vehicle fleet toward more electric and lower emitting technologies slows, it could mean that for people in Southern California who are living near freeways, that the higher pollution levels could potentially continue for longer. You know, one of the things that state officials tell us is that, hey, you know, this is a problem, the fact that so many people live next to freeways, but it's going to be easing over time as pollution controls get stricter and stricter. But now you're seeing at the federal level discussion of perhaps easing the move toward cleaner vehicles. So that's kind of where the rub is.
You reported on an analysis by the American Thoracic Society finding that air pollution contributes to as many early deaths as traffic accidents.
Right.
So you're saying it's a very big problem, air pollution still. Not quite as bad as it was in the 1970s.
Yeah, what I tried to point out was that's after decades of improvements. You know, we've long known that air pollution cuts lives short and leads to a whole host of health problems, everything from asthma to heart attacks and even things like dementia and brain conditions. But what's really astonishing is just the public health impact. So even after decades of cleaning up the air, there still are, you know, according to scientists, thousands of people in Southern California who do not live as long as they otherwise would have.
Now, you did speak to Mayor Garcetti about this, and he was, I don't want to say sanguine, but he certainly was in favor of continuing to build near freeways because we have a housing issue that we have to address. Were you surprised that that he sort of was so confident that the problem could be resolved with building design and cleaning up tailpipe emissions?
Well, you know, it's not surprising in the sense that Mayor Garcetti and a lot of local officials have made it a top priority to increase the housing stock. You know, I think there is widespread agreement that there is a severe shortage of housing and affordable housing in Los Angeles. And I think anyone who's looked for an apartment or a home to buy can attest to that. What I was a bit surprised to hear was that, Mayor Garcetti does not support any any limits on the amount of housing. So his position is that he believes the more appropriate and effective way of dealing with this issue is to let pollution regulators deal with the tailpipe emissions, and that at the city level, mandate air filtration and improvements in building design. But he doesn't believe that there should be any limits on, you know, the number of, or any, you know, prohibitions or anything like that on how much development can go in next to polluted freeways.
And then lastly, you talked about both living near freeways, but also near mass transit lines. Aren't mass transit lines meant to be a cleaner, less polluting form of energy, or is it because the mass transit lines are often near the freeways?
Right. What you have is city and state policies that favor the concentration of development, you know, near transit. And kind of an unintended consequence there is that some of our transit lines, you know, whether they're buses, subways, or, you know, metro stations, happen to be in high traffic corridors. So you have one, you know, a policy that's trying to concentrate development in the urban core to fight climate change and reduce the amount of sprawl, coming up against the problem of situating many new people next to pollution sources.
That was Tony Barbosa. He covers air quality and the environment for the Los Angeles Times. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up, the enfant terrible of fashion, Rick Owens, takes on big ideas in his runway shows.
We're talking about masculinity when we're talking about men's clothes. We're talking about what makes a man.
More from Rick Owens about his fashion and his furniture after this break. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. The fashion designer Rick Owens loves to break the rules. His provocative runway shows have become notorious, and his reputation for dramatic black clothing has earned him the nickname the Godfather of Brutal Chic. Owens was raised in Porterville, California. He studied at Otis College of Art and Design and at LA Trade Tech, and he launched his own company right here in LA. Then he moved to Paris in 2003. It puts him right in the center of the high fashion universe.
I could be anywhere, though, to tell you the truth, because I live in my own little bubble, and it's the same bubble I lived in Los Angeles. And it's about work. It's about going to a gym close by. It's about a couple of restaurants and traveling back and forth to the factory in Italy. So that could be anywhere.
Owens has not been back to LA since he moved away, not even for the opening of a show of furniture he designed that is currently on view at the Moca Pacific Design Center in West Hollywood. The chairs and benches have a raw quality similar to his clothing, and it's a project that began after he moved to Paris with his wife, the former fashion designer turned restaurateur Michelle Lamy. She was famed in the late 90s and early aughts for her Hollywood hangout, Les Deux Cafés.
The thing about Michelle is that she is a wild animal that you cannot really control. And I think she was chomping at the bit to be free, kind of. And this was kind of an opportunity. She just, because one time I came back and she goes, you know what, we should just move to Europe. And I go, you think so? And she goes, yeah, well, let's go and think about it. And when she came with me to Europe, I noticed that she packed a bag that was a little, because we travel very, very light. And the bag that she packed was a little bit fuller than usual. And I said, wait, you're never coming back, are you? And she said, oh, of course I am. But she never did. She came to Europe and we just settled into Paris and we found a place to live and she moved in and that was it. She just kind of left that restaurant. And we started the furniture because the showroom needed furniture and then we needed furniture for the house. And we'd always built things and created things. And so that became something that she fell in love with. And what started is very brutalist pieces for the showroom and for the house. It kind of developed a life of its own. And what it became was almost this dialogue between her and me. There are certain shapes that I feel very strongly about and that just end up in my clothes, in anything, and certain shapes that I wanted for the house. And among those shapes, there were certain shapes that she responded to the most. And so gradually we kind of built this body of work in the furniture through going back and forth. And that's kind of what this Mocha show is about, I think.
Visitors to Owen's show will see shapes that don't bear much in common with traditional furniture. They're monumental, with totems towering almost to the ceiling and benches extending the length of a room. They're not in the least bit cozy looking.
Yeah, the furniture is a little abstracted, because when you were kind of a theatrical couple, I mean, we believe in pursuing an aesthetic ideal as far as you can, like going over the cliff with an aesthetic ideal. The things that we wear and the things that we pursue aesthetically are probably going to be a lot more extreme than a lot of people, just because we've kind of devoted ourselves to it. So, like, for instance, with runway shows, the collections that I show on the runway are exaggerated versions of what I sell in the stores. I sell the stuff on the runway for sure, but I realize that it's probably a lot further than most people are willing to go. But I feel a responsibility to go as far as I can, because runway shows are about, or high fashion in Paris is about experimentation. If you want really good looking clothes, there are other places to go. I sell good-looking clothes, but I want my clothes to go a little bit further than just be good-looking. So for the Mocha show, it's easy to look at this stuff and say, you know, nobody can live with this. And I get it. We can live with it. And I think people who are interested in going out on an aesthetic limb can live with it. But I readily admit it's not for everybody, and I'm not proposing it for everybody. It's just a modest proposal. It's not a manifesto. It's an aesthetic proposal.
But the aesthetic proposal does have some certain motifs, and one of them is a kind of astounding scale. And then there's the mm-hmm. use of these sort of elemental materials. You know, you've got the marble, the alabaster, the bronze. I mean, there's a very distinct aesthetic there. And what is that about?
I think that I'm speaking to people who have embraced land art, who have embraced art de pauvre, who have embraced brutalist architecture. You know, I described this furniture as something that I wish that I would want to decorate Michael Heiser's city installation with. Like, it's in the desert landscape, and it's kind of an abstract, empty, utopian, futuristic landscape.
Michael Heiser's the artist who, by the way, created the levitated mass artwork at LACMA.
Yeah. I'm having this mad romance with Michael Heiser right this minute. There's this movie that's out that came out on iTunes called Troublemakers, and it's all about the land artists of the 70s. And that moment with Michael Heiser, Walter DeMaria, Robert Smithson, that moment of breaking out of the gallery space and going into the middle of the desert and making these huge earthworks, that's just thrilling to me. You know, I have that movie on every morning while I'm showering with the sound off, just to have those visuals. And when you look at that movie, there's these great-looking guys with beards and shaggy hair, and they're going out into the desert with cranes and with bulldozers, and they're creating these landscapes, and it's just heroic. It's just on this huge scale, and it's very moving, and it's about survival, and it's about aspiring to maybe control your environment. And it's poignant because, you know, we inevitably fail. We're human and we perish. And this landscape and our environment goes on without us. So there is this heroic struggle, though, that's so appealing to me, because it's kind of about pursuing this potential that is beyond yourself. of creating something bigger than you really are before you die. It's like a bumblebee or something. It's just this human cycle thing that I love.
You're listening to designer Rick Owens. Now, it turns out that his fall 2017 menswear collection also seemed to be playing with ideas of survival. The outfits looked as if they'd been made of twisted sleeping bags, a play perhaps on puffy jackets. Women's Wear Daily wrote that the collection was, quote, more reminiscent of modern-day nomads dragging their blankets and belongings around on their backs. Now, some people might see this collection and think of the actual modern-day nomads, the refugees of Europe, for example, or here in Los Angeles, the thousands of homeless people on our streets. I asked Rick Owens whether that perception might concern him.
I am aware that anything that I can do can offend somebody somewhere on this planet. I'm trying to talk about more eternal values. I'm trying to look at our condition from a longer perspective. I'm thinking of the human condition in the context of a million years, not in the context of this year in downtown Los Angeles or downtown. I mean, and I don't mean to be insensitive, but if I was afraid of offending somebody, I wouldn't move a finger. I mean, I would be paralyzed. The thing about fashion, though, is that all of a sudden it has become this huge sporting event that's shown the world over. So in the context of downtown Los Angeles, my little world is of no interest to their concerns or their needs, and I totally understand where it would seem offensive, maybe. I can't really let that stop me, though.
I do want to talk, though, about the sport of fashion. You just referred to fashion being now as this global sporting event. You're a sprinter with your four shows a year. We in LA have the so-called LA Fashion Week, and yet there are those in the industry that say, does LA even need a fashion week? Can you give us your thoughts on that?
Well, no, my answer is no. But I do believe in Paris fashion shows. You know, there's fashion all over the place, and I don't think it's a bad thing in that there will always be a... Does it sound snotty saying the cream always rises to the top? I mean, there'll always be kind of an elitist top layer, and I think Paris has that, and I think that, you know, that just happens. But the thing about fashion shows, though, is because people said, you know, the fashion shows are over, but I really don't think so. I think they're ceremonies, and I've been talking about this a lot. I think they're a contemporary ceremony. It's people have gathered together to listen to a story over a fire or go to the movies or watch TV in their den with their friends and family. People need to gather together to experience something together. And I think a runway show it can be about beauty or it can be about ideas of beauty or explorations of beauty. And my runway shows, I like them to be about considering different options of beauty, considering beauty from a different perspective, or considering things that might be considered non-beautiful.
You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton, and we're speaking with fashion designer Rick Owens. Now, one of his most buzzed about shows was in 2014. He enlisted sorority hip-hop dancers, most of them plus-size women of color, to present his spring-summer collection called Vicious. The women performed a type of dance known as step dancing. They stomped, clapped, and made fierce faces.
It was kind of a way of talking about power and confidence and how I think all of us, with a certain amount of confidence and in their case, almost ferocity, and shown under a spotlight, we can all be beautiful in a certain way. That was kind of my message, but it was also about teamwork. And, you know, the whole history behind stepping that I thought was very poignant was it started in black sororities It was during the integration in the 60s, and there was a period where there was rioting because of integration. And there were supposedly, and I'm certainly no scholar or authority on this, but supposedly there were some of these steps in stepping were inspired by the groups of black students that had to lock arms to get through the riots to get into school. And I thought that the idea of grace under pressure and grace in the face of adversity, or unity in the face of adversity, I think those are emotions that any of us can relate to. And the idea of clinging together in the face of adversity, I thought there was, that's kind of a universal emotion. But also, of course, it was provocative to put this in a fashion show context. But part of what I do is celebrate rules and certain values, but I also like to tease them a little gently. I like to say, well, why don't we stretch the rules a little bit? Or what if we broke the rules this one time? Would everything fall apart? And of course, I can be accused of like cultural appropriation, which is also provocative and funny. The world is so squeamish about being politically correct right now. I thought, okay, you know, what if it's a little politically incorrect? Is that like the worst thing in the world either? So I was kind of playing, I was kind of teasing all of those rules.
You have a whole side to your work that could be called transgressive. However, right now with the, I guess, sort of mainstreaming of, say, transgender culture, the question might be sort of what is transgressive these days and how does one transgress? I know it's something that you've explored. You've got your exposed penis show right now. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, the exposed penis show thing. I mean, first of all, I think the clothes were very beautiful. And if the clothes hadn't been technically good, it would have just been a stunt. But even if I hadn't had the penises on the in the show, I was proud of the clothes and of the collection. The penis thing was, sure, it's provocative. And, you know, when you do a show with makeup and lights and certain kind of models, the whole thing is theater. So to be accused of being theatrical is like a little silly under those conditions. We're talking about masculinity when we're talking about men's clothes. We're talking about what makes a man. And the thing about the penis is it's the weirdest thing, how it can be kind of so sacred and so profane at the same time. But whereas women's bodies have been exploited forever. And I was thinking, what if we lived in a world where it didn't matter, where the penis was not this strange symbol of power, but almost vulnerability? You know, it's like I'm raising the question of what's the big deal? And that was an interesting question, I thought.
That was fashion designer Rick Owens. His furniture is still on display at Mocha Pacific Design Center in West Hollywood. The show closes April 2nd. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening.